supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The Pennsylvania legislature has a little more than 2 weeks to redraw its congressional map. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Last week, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that the state's congressional map violates the state constitution. The court ordered lawmakers to draw a new map and have Governor Tom Wolf sign off on it by February 15th. Keystone Crossroads' Lindsay Lazarski reports that the court's decision has left candidates running for Congress in a state of uncertainty and confusion.
And if that doesn't happen, if they don't come to the Supreme Court.
Sandwiched in an office between a beauty salon and a gadget repair shop in South Philadelphia, Nina Ahmed is going over the timeline with her campaign manager.
That's what they said.
The petition gathering will be affected, clearly.
Ahmed, a scientist and former deputy mayor, is one of the challengers running against incumbent Bob Brady in the 1st Congressional District's upcoming Democratic primary.
This is a scrappy kind of can-do campaign. We have to be. I am the challenger to a really established incumbent.
She agrees with the state Supreme Court's decision to throw out the old map.
This is good for democracy, that we are undoing this terribly gerrymandered districts in Pennsylvania.
Despite any logistical snags caused by the court decision, Ahmed welcomes a change to the district. She thinks the shape could be more compact.
It's because people did unconstitutional things. That's why we're facing this. And I think we have to hold people accountable for that.
In the meantime, her campaign is operating as if the existing map stands.
For me, you know, we'll just roll with the punches, whatever we have to do.
Not all candidates see the court's decision as fair, especially when many across the state have been campaigning for months in districts that could now change dramatically. In the crowded field of the 15th Congressional District, more than 10 candidates are vying to replace Congressman Charlie Dent, one of five Pennsylvania Republican congressmen who aren't seeking re-election. Dean Browning, a former Lehigh County commissioner, is running as a Republican candidate.
I think it is really unfair to the voters. For example, we have had candidates that have declared for this race as far back as last September. They have been campaigning throughout the Pennsylvania 15th Congressional District. Voters have had a chance to evaluate them or start to form an opinion. And now, suddenly, that's all going to be scrambled.
The 15th District currently stretches about 100 miles across five counties, and there's no way to know which of those communities will be in or out of the next version of the district. Based on history, Browning has decided to focus his efforts in the Lehigh Valley. This uncertainty is frustrating to Lebanon County Democrat Laura Quick, who's got mixed feelings about the court's ruling.
I know historically, as a Democrat, that it's been very unfair the way the lines have been drawn, but I have been working within these lines. I've been coloring within the lines for 2 years now, and that's all up in smoke if they decide to go with a different map.
Quick is a UPS worker and former teacher who managed to nail down an endorsement from the Teamsters Union. She's committed to running for Congress and to representing Lebanon County, which, depending on how the lines are drawn, may mean she ends up running in a different race.
It's a mess. There's just way too many questions right now than answers.
Candidates in the 12th Congressional District also have a lot of questions. The oddly shaped district skirts the Ohio border northwest of Pittsburgh and then juts southeast for more than 100 miles past Johnstown. Republican incumbent Keith Rothfuss lives in suburban Pittsburgh and could potentially be drawn out of the district. If that were to happen, nothing in the law would prevent him from still pursuing the seat. Same for Aaron Anthony, a PhD student at the University of Pittsburgh. He's hoping to be the Democratic challenger, but would consider dropping out depending on how the map is drawn.
On one hand, it's business as usual. On the other hand, it's really unknown. We kind of have to look at a big picture about this is great for Pennsylvania representation writ large, but really hard to map out a specific game plan for what it means for our specific campaign.
Despite the confusion, some Democrats, especially in Republican strongholds like the 5th District, see opportunity with a new map. Mark Friedenberg, a professor at Penn State, is one of three Democrats running against Republican incumbent Glenn Thompson.
This decision, it's a huge motivation for me. It means that we really have a chance in 2018 to make some real Democratic reforms.
Spanning 16 counties from the shores of Lake Erie to central Pennsylvania, the district is huge. And Thompson won handily in 2016. He released a statement along with Rothfuss, Dent, and seven other Republican incumbents, calling the court's decision, quote, misguided. While candidates wait in limbo for a new map, Republican defendants in the case are fighting the court's decision through an emergency appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Lindsay Lazarski, Keystone Crossroads.
The eyes of America will be on the Eagles this Sunday as they take on the Patriots in Super Bowl 52. Well, not all eyes. Many fans will tune out the game as part of a boycott of the NFL that's been gaining steam throughout the season. NewsWorks Tonight producer Shai Ben-Yakov spoke with reporter Daryl Murphy, who's been talking to those boycotting the game and those who aren't.
Well, Daryl Murphy, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
First off, let's define this movement. Who's boycotting and what are they boycotting over?
The people who are boycotting are supporters of Colin Kaepernick after last season when he began kneeling in protest of racial injustice in the country. You know, he generated a lot of support. And the next season when he entered free agency, no other team would pick him up. And a lot of the experts deemed that he was a viable starter. And so, you know, the question became, why isn't anybody picking up Colin Kaepernick? And so suspicions of collusion between owners who had some racist intentions kind of bubbled up. And then eventually the movement began to boycott the NFL among some of these among some of his supporters.
And we should say there are actually those boycotting the NFL for the opposite reason, because of the NFL protest. We heard that a number of like American Legion posts in the area have tuned out the games for a lot of the season. I also heard about a veterans group that tried to take out a Super Bowl ad that advocates standing for the anthem. They were rejected by the NFL. What do you think were some major points during this NFL season when fans started to tune out? What were some of the big moments?
Well, definitely, I'd say earlier in the season when Donald Trump started tweeting and disparaging the NFL and the owners for not taking a stance against these players who were kneeling, and also urging his followers to boycott the NFL, more or less, you know, calling them sons of bitches and that type of thing. So that's where you started to see the other side started to say, okay, we're not going to watch it because we don't like these players boycotting, disrespecting the flag, et cetera, et cetera.
You talked to some fans who were participating in the boycott. So one person you talked to was Herman Douglas. He's a teacher, and he's with the Caucus of Working Educators. And let's hear what he had to say.
I didn't have the opportunity to march with Dr. King. You know, I was born in 1973, so that was way before my time, the civil rights era. And for me to just to sit there and say, okay, Colin Kaepernick has done something that I haven't been able to see someone actually do, walk away from really millions of dollars to take a stand, and the only thing I have to do was something very small. I really never really contributed big to any type of movement.
Did you hear that a lot from people, that they felt that this was their civil rights moment, people who were born perhaps after the civil rights movement?
No, not to that extent. I think it revealed what football meant to people. I think it was more, I think the impact was felt more personally than anything. You know, one person, they just gave up in the middle because, you know, football meant too much to them, the connection between their family and nostalgia, you know. And I think, you know, in a city like this where football is so prevalent, that's pretty much the case for a lot of people.
Now, you talked also to people who sympathized with a lot of the points of the movement, but were not participating. And what were some reasons there?
There was some movement within the league from the Players Coalition that was led by Malcolm Jenkins and Anquan Boldin, where they actually reached a negotiation for the league to donate about $90 million to different social causes that the players were concerned about.
And they felt that resolved the issue to some extent?
To some extent, yeah. And also, the end game of the boycott was very unclear.
Well, you talked to a radio personality, Ikey Raw, and here's one thing he had to say.
These people want to talk about a protest, protest the NFL? Really? Where's y'all at when these black men been murdered in the street? Where's y'all at when other black men is killing other black men in the streets? You know what I'm saying? Where's y'all at then? Where's y'all at when they're talking to these kids in the streets? But y'all worried about what's going on with Colin Kaepernick and the boycott? Really? Really?
Was that something that you heard a lot of, that people thought this was like window dressing, like people weren't doing enough on the ground?
Not so much as that, but more to the extent of like, how are we going to apply this in a way that's going to be meaningful in the end? You know, because after the season's over, what's going to happen? The next season, what's going to happen? You know, are we going to keep on boycotting, you know?
So, well, I was going to ask about that, because even though the players may not be protesting anymore, they've started this movement that's now picking up. It's a little bit out of their hands. So what do you think is going to happen next year?
It's unclear, but definitely the issues have been raised, and it's quite possible that you know, the NFL is already, the viewership is already on a downward trend. And this season was the lowest it's been in 3 years.
Daryl Murphy, thank you so much for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you.
That's Newsworks Tonight producer Shai Ben-Yaakov speaking with reporter Daryl Murphy. You can read his story at WHYY.org. Will you be sidelining the big game in protest for one reason or another? Let us know. You can send a note or a recorded audio comment to Newsworks Tonight at WHYY.org. 8 months ago, someone gunned down a Philadelphia man in a home invasion that remains unsolved. Now, his cousin is working to help other families avoid the heartbreak that her family endured. WHYY's Dana DeFilippo reports.
Cash Garner was watching TV in his living room in the West Oak Lane neighborhood late one night last June when someone burst in through the back door and shot him to death. It looked like an execution. The killer fired 14 times and left without taking anything. But police got nowhere and now consider the investigation stalled. That's not unusual. Most killers in Philadelphia are never caught. Homicide detectives solved about 43% of all murders last year. Meanwhile, murders are up in the city. 317 people died by homicide last year, up 14% from the year before. Garner's cousin, Davida Garner, says both trends need to end. She says police and some residents are complacent.
Because it's just another black boy killed. In all honesty, I really feel like that's what it is. They see it every day. I've never been against the police. I'm not against the police. I feel like we need them in the community.
But, she says, when the murder victim is a police officer or a white person,
they know it by the end of the week. The same effort and whatever you did to find this guy's killer, you should put this into these young black boys that are dying. Because what's going to happen is it's going to be retaliation and your homicide rate is just going to go up.
Captain Jack Ryan heads Philly's homicide unit. He says detectives do a lot of investigating that families never see.
There's not investigative steps being undone. Sometimes the family's not happy with the direction that we take, but we can't disclose everything that we're doing to the family members. And we'll update them on the progress, but sometimes only in very general terms.
He has other theories about why murders are up and why fewer are getting solved. For example, he says, more than half of the city's murders are drug-related, and drug dealers don't talk to police.
When you have drug killings and your witnesses are other drug dealers or other people in the trade, and they're by nature not willing to cooperate, so it's not even just a question of, you know, your regular folks working for a living not wanting to come forward.
His unit got 11 more detectives last year, and that has helped them solve more cases. But he welcomes any help the community wants to offer. And Davida Garner, she has plenty of ideas as far as that goes. She started a grassroots group called Erase the Rate, a reference to the city's rising murder rate. Her goal? To prevent more homicides while supporting families who lose loved ones to murder. She raised money in December to buy holiday gifts for victims' families. Next month, she plans to honor murder victims with a march to the morgue.
That's our commonplace, is the morgue.
She says the so-called Walk to End Homicide on February 10th will be a show of resilience and unity for anyone who has lost someone to murder. She also hopes to persuade clergy and celebrities to join her cause. After all, she figures, the bigger the voices that preach against violence, the more successful they'll be in reducing it.
This is a quote from Albert Einstein. It says, "The world is a dangerous place to live, not because of the people who are evil, but because of the people who don't do anything about it." So that's my favorite quote, because that shows that it's time to change. We have to actually start pouring into our community in order for us to get the results that we need.
Dana DeFilippo, WHYY News.
One of the oldest and largest single-day events for African-American children's books in the country, the 26th Annual African-American Children's Books Fair, is set to take place Saturday at Community College of Philadelphia. Among the acclaimed authors and illustrators in attendance from across the country will be Philadelphia resident Christine Kendall, author of the book entitled Riding Chance, It's How the Game is Played. Christine, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Philadelphia native, and I understand your debut offering is set in Philadelphia.
Right.
What's the theme?
Riding Chance. It's a coming-of-age story about a kid who needs to find himself. He's not a bad kid, but he's confused. His mother's recently passed away, and his father's consumed by grief. He feels all alone. He gets into a little bit of trouble and ends up being placed in a mentoring program where he comes into contact with horses and the game of polo. And through those two things, discovers what type of person he is and what type of man he wants to be.
WHYY NPR listeners might be familiar with a piece a few years back on this Work to Ride program. Did that in part inspire you as well?
That is absolutely what inspired me. I had been attempting to write picture books. I didn't realize that I was a novelist. But one morning, I was listening to NPR, and I heard this phenomenal story about the kids out at the Chamonix Equestrian Center who play polo and who had just won the 2011 championships. And I thought, this is a fantastic story. I went online, I did some more research, and I found a photograph of some of the kids in the program, and that inspired me to try to write a novel.
Would you share with us a passage from the book?
Yes, I'd be happy to. What you need to know to understand this scene is this is the first time that Troy, that's my protagonist, actually gets up on the horse, Chance. I laid back and I could feel her backbone up against mine, like we were connected or something. Next thing I knew, my eyes were closed and I could feel the sun beating down on me. The sun was so warm, it felt like I was laying out on a beach, but without the sand. And you know what came into my head? My mom, from out of nowhere. Laying there on Chance, I was seeing my mom. She was in the sunshine all around me. Felt like how it used to be when she was alive. I just let everything go. I wasn't thinking about frontin' or nothing.
What comes of that initial encounter?
Well, Troy is fascinated after this experience and wants to stay in the riding program and wants to get as involved as he possibly can. But unfortunately, his friend Foster is far less enamored. Actually, he doesn't want to continue the program. So there's a little rift between the two friends. And one evening, Troy is walking home from Foster's house, and he stopped and experiences an aggressive experience with the police. He stop and frisk. And that experience hardens him. And so basically has to come to terms with himself. He has to realize, what kind of person do I want to be? Do I want to allow this one experience to define me, or do I want to move past it?
A Philadelphia native, you went to New York for several years and came back. And I understand you've also come back to this children's book fair.
Oh, yes. The annual African-American Children's Book Fair is a wonderful event. Vanessa Lloyd-Scombati started it 26 years ago. It is an incredible amount of work, but she comes back year after year after year with a great staff of volunteers, and they put this book fair together. It's an opportunity for African-American writers to come to the community and present our work. It's a celebration of writing. She has about 3,500 people attending the event every year. It is a big, big deal. And one of the things that I find so much fun about it is, before I became a writer, I attended the book fair as a consumer. I went to the book fair and bought books, never imagining that I would be actually sitting on the other side of the table.
Can you recall your experience as a kid young reader and how that informs what you do now as a writer for this generation's young readers?
That's a good question. I always loved books. And when I think back on my childhood, I recall weekly trips to the library. But I can't necessarily recall specific books that I read. And I think part of the reason is because those books didn't necessarily mirror who I was. There weren't very many, if any, books written that featured African-American characters. So even though I loved reading, I always felt a slight disconnect. We've made progress in the sense that there's greater representation now, but there's still a lot of work that needs to be done.
The African-American Children's Book Fair takes place Saturday at Community College of Philadelphia. I've been speaking with Christine Kendall, author of the book entitled Riding Chance, It's How the Game is Played. Finally this evening, Philadelphia police today detailed their plans to deal with crowds after Sunday's Super Bowl. Philadelphians can expect beefed up patrols of both city cops and state police. But the real question is, how to deter rowdy fans from climbing traffic light poles? It's a task that's so far eluded authorities. The trend has spawned jokes and memes on social media, but Philadelphia Police Commissioner Richard Ross says it's no laughing matter.
During these occasions, people invariably, some, want to climb poles for some reason. I don't particularly understand that, but that's just something that happens. And so we have an obligation to try to keep them safe, as well as the people who they could fall down on. And so we have to be mindful of all of that.
Slathering the poles in Crisco before the NFC Championship game wasn't enough to deter climbers, but police say they're breaking out a secret formula Sunday. Hey, anybody for Cheese Whiz? That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.